The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
One of this century's great landmarks in the biological sciences was the public release in 2003 of the map of the human genome. But this initial outline of our DNA found only 2% was the genes that code for our protein building blocks. In the intervening years, a consortium of international scientists working on a project called ENCODE have made great gains in mapping the so-called desert regions of the genome. Recently, ENCODE released a raft of 30 papers on their research and made public their growing encyclopedia on the human gene pool. Alok Jha met with one of the scientists on the project, British scientist Dr. Ewan Burney, to discuss the expanding frontiers of genomic science.
So Ewan, just tell me the story so far with the Human Genome Project. That was sequenced 2000-2003. So what did we learn then, and sort of what happened in the 10 years since?
So in 2000, we published the draft human genome. 2003, we published the finished human genome. And we always knew that was just going to be a starting point, a kind of foundation. And in fact, there were some pretty high-level meetings at that time to ask ourselves, what do we do next? And what's the next set of things that you want to do? So one line, which is not the work here, is about variation, how we're different between people, and then how those differences are associated with disease. The other line was just, how does the genome work? We knew that the genome had protein coding genes in them, but we knew that was the minority. In fact, a very small amount of the DNA was involved in protein coding genes.
Something like 2%.
1.2% is protein coding exons, and maybe closer to 2% is all the exons involved in protein coding genes. So the next question is, how does a genome work? How is it? This is a recipe book for one of us, for a human being, and what is the recipes beyond the protein coding genes?
And so this was an attempt to try and understand what the other 98% was doing. Now, Typically, and this is wrong now, but it's been called junk DNA because we didn't know what it did and no discernible function was attached to it. Tell us why you would want to study junk DNA, first of all, and then why that name is maybe a misnomer.
So we always knew that protein coding genes were not the whole story. So in particular, we know that protein coding genes get switched on and off in different cell types. So your liver cell has lots of enzymes involved with metabolizing maybe bad compounds and also alcohol and all sorts of different things. Whereas your hair cells makes keratin. Now, the hair cell knows that it should make keratin and not these liver enzymes. The liver cell knows that it should make the liver enzymes, not the hair. That control must have been somewhere in the genome, and we always knew for some individual genes that it was indeed in elements sometimes quite far away from a gene. But we didn't really have a genome-wide view of this, so where all the elements were. So we set about trying to work out how we could discover those elements. And certainly one of the big surprises is we see way more elements, way, way, way more elements than I was expecting walking into the project and more than many other scientists did.
And so these control elements are all in that, let's call it, non-coding DNA element. Now, give me a helicopter view of the ENCODE results as published now. How much of the genome, how much of this non-coding DNA are you starting to understand? And kind of give me a context of how significant that is, that we've now started to understand these things.
So at one level, we've looked across the entire genome. And at one level, we look at every time there's something very specific going on in a place in the genome. And when you sum all of that up, it's 80% of the genome. Now, that's a pretty big number, way above 2%. But it shouldn't actually be a number to surprise you, because this is looking at all the times when a gene is on or off. And although the protein coding exons are very small, genes are quite big. There's large bits that are cut out. So this is, in some sense, that 80% is the total amount that is either switched on or off in a particular cell line. Now, what is just as important, in fact, for me, much more interesting, are the switches, or the places that we think are controlling which bits are on and off. And our best estimate of or what we've discovered, about 6% of the genome, when you add that up with exons, it's a total of 9% of the genome, is involved in either exons or these very specific switches, where a specific protein is binding a specific piece of DNA sequence. Now, ENCODE was genome-wide. It is a very it's a larger-scale project of this sort, but did not survey every type of protein that can bind DNA, and it didn't survey every cell type that's in our body. But we've got some estimate of what we expect the saturation curve to look like as we add in more and more experiments. And so that 9% we believe to be, it's definitely not everything in this category, and we think that may go up to 18% or 20%. Looking at the way these things saturate. So that's, for me, is a surprising number, that 20% of our genome could well be involved in specific regulation. And that's surprisingly big for most scientists.
So just stepping back from that slightly, so the 1% to 2% that codes for proteins, these are the things that you're familiar with. They're the genes that code for every protein in your body, that does every single function, all your muscles, hormones, all those sorts of things. And then the extra 6% that you're finding now, these are things that turn those protein coding genes on, off, maybe upregulate, downregulate. Yep. And how important are they to how healthy someone is, or how well these protein coding things are working?
So this was the other beautiful moment in ENCODE, because we compared the ENCODE results to these disease studies that have also been looking genome-wide. And in these disease studies, they take a disease, sometimes heart disease, so whether you have a heart attack or not, or a type of cancer or Crohn's disease, and they look at healthy people, people who don't have the disease and people who do have the disease, and say, is there any little bit of genome that's associated with changing the risk of this? Now, the surprising thing in those disease studies is about between 50% to 75% of the elements that they find are not close to protein coding genes. They're away from protein coding genes. And these have always been a bit difficult for people to deal with, because we know very little, or we did know very little. Now, when we bring that together with ENCODE, there is a surprising overlap between the ENCODE information, where switches are that switch things on and off, and where these disease risk places are. And that's been a beautiful thing. Actually, when it was first... when we first saw that result, I thought it was a bit too good to be true. I had to be persuaded myself. We've done the analysis about 5 different ways now, and it still definitely holds up.
Can you give me some examples of those, and what kinds of regulation causes what kinds of disease, for example?
Just to give you some perspective here, it's always easy to talk about the examples where it agrees with how we understand how the disease works. There are other examples which I'm less comfortable about talking about, because I'm not confident. All manner of weird and wonderful artifacts occur in the system.
Well, given that we're at the beginning of this sort of research, then go for the ones you're confident about.
It's okay. So one of our little poster childs is Crohn's disease. This is a very it's an awful disease of the gut, an autoimmune disease. That's when your body turns on yourself, and we've always known that it was involved in somehow in the immune system. And indeed, when we look at the ENCODE, the risk, the places which change risk for this disease across the genome do overlap very heavily with T helper cells. Now, T helper cells are part of the immune system, and everybody sort of expected this. Now, what was less expected was that the Crohn's disease elements also overlapped with a transcription factor called GATA2. Actually, GATA2 is a member of a family that we call the GATA family, and there's quite a lot of reasons why we think it's the family of transcription factors, not GATA2 in particular. But that wasn't something expected by Crohn's disease biologists. So we confirm one thing that the Crohn's disease people know about, and then we also say to them, well, maybe you should have a look over here at this transcription factor. How is that this transcription factor is influencing the risk for disease?
Just explain what a transcription factor is for me.
Sure. A transcription factor is a protein sequence which binds a specific piece of DNA. And one important way to think about this is that we are trying to understand how the genome works. It's like a very complicated book in Russian, and we don't know any Russian, and we're trying to teach ourselves Russian. But we do know of a machine that understands DNA, and that machine is ourselves themselves. So we have a machine that understands it. We can look at that machine, and by looking at that machine, we work out where specific proteins bind to DNA. We call those specific proteins transcription factors.
Okay, so this begins to make the understanding of disease at the same time more powerful, but also fiendishly more complicated. I mean, we've kind of spent the last decade or so looking at finding amazing things out about diseases from genetics. I mean, gone are the days when one mutation causes one disease, and that's what we understand about genetics. In the past couple of years, for the past few years, we've had these things called genome-wide association studies, where you compare the genomes of people with a particular disease with people with that don't have that disease, and you look at what the many, many gene factors and gene mutations are that are different between them. So you get this sort of large data set. Your data set just increases all of that. So just explain to me how the kind of work you're doing and will continue to do, I assume, how it fits in with that sort of process of increasing the amount of genetic information we have. And what does it add to genome-wide association studies, for example, that allows them to fill in certain blanks? Yeah.
So I think one of the things to say is that we felt maybe life was much easier beforehand and more comfortable because we were just much more ignorant. And indeed now the major thing that's happening is we're losing some of our ignorance, and indeed it's really complicated. I mean, you've got to remember these genomes make one of the most complicated things we know, which is ourselves. We are really, really hideously complicated machines. And the idea that the recipe book would be easy to understand is kind of a bit of hubris, really.
Did anyone think that, though, really, back in the 90s?
No, but there's one thing about writing it down and saying to yourself, oh, I bet it's going to be a bit complicated. And there's another thing about seeing the full level of complexity. And believe you me, I find it, I mean, I have lived this for 10 years, and I find it bamboozling. I find it, it's very difficult to keep everything in your head at the same time and what's going on. In fact, we have to use computers. We have to use systems to provide this understanding. So, and I still think we're at the start of this journey. We're not even the middle of the race yet. We're still in the warm-up, the first couple of miles of this marathon, I think.
And so your study, how does it build on those GWAS and other sorts of things?
So that goes back to my previous answer. That the GWAS studies had found these areas of risk. So it depends on the disease, but usually 50% to 75% of these risk regions were out in the middle of nowhere. We're not close to protein-coding genes. And when they're listed in those GWAS studies, people just have to say, well, we know nothing about what this bit of the genome's doing. So it's kind of put down as anonymous region.
But we know that it's not a gene.
Well, so we know it's not a protein-coding gene, yes. And one can get into this slightly philosophical debate about what a gene is, but let's just leave it in a precise way and say we know it's not a protein-coding gene. So a lot of the time, we see it overlapping with this ENCODE data, and that was statistically significant even when we controlled for many, many, many different factors. And what we've it's really been a lovely thing seeing these two data sets coming together. And what I think is going to be going on here is opening new doors for the disease community. So a disease community may have been studying a particular disease and have some ideas about which cell types in the body that disease is associated with, which molecular processes. Well, the ENCODE data provides a kind of genome-wide view of all of this and can say, well, have you thought about this cell type, or have you thought about this transcription factor or this type of RNA when you're looking at this particular disease? Sometimes that's in line with what we've known previously, like the Crohn's disease and the T helper cells. Sometimes it is a bit more surprising and head-scratching. And we have 400 to 500 such disease factor, disease cell type associations, which we think are worth getting into. And as our ability to understand disease gets better and our ability to understand the genome gets better, that will just keep on going up.
Now, let's talk a bit about what this regulation system does. How does it work? So the typical gene idea, for people who don't know, is that you have a gene sequence, a DNA sequence that encodes a gene, and that means that some RNAs are produced, which are single-stranded versions of DNA, essentially, that read the DNA, They go off to a bit of the cell, which then makes a protein. Out comes the protein. Off we go. What are these transcription, are these other regulatory bits doing? I mean, they're sequences of DNA. Take us from there. What happens in the cell?
Yeah, so we've long known that the place where the RNA starts, which we call the promoter, has been a big focus of kind of why a gene is switched on in your liver cell and not your hair cell. Sort of the decision has to happen at that point. And indeed, a lot of the switches that we find are very close to that promoter sequence. That's the biggest concentration, is at the start of genes. But beyond that, there's a large amount of information scattered elsewhere. Now, biologists for individual genes have always known that this has been the case. They're called enhancers when they promote. They're sometimes called repressors and sometimes insulators for other functionality. So we see not just a little bit of this, we see a lot of this going on. And that's probably, again, the biggest surprise, certainly for me, is just how much is going on. You can't move for switches in the genome. So we do believe, and there's good evidence, Joop Dekker from Massachusetts studied this, where we see places where the DNA bends and touches, so that enhancer that was, if you drew the DNA out just as a line, was a long way away from the promoter at the start of the gene. And now what we think is in the cell, there's a three-dimensional structure, and in fact, those two things touch and they have looping interactions. But even that sort of level, it's really non-trivial to work out what's going on and very complex. So when you look at all the interactions, you get a little bit... it's just daunting to see how much is going on there. And so this is not it's not a simple thing to diagram out. Now, that's for us to go on and explore some more. It's important to realize that ENCODE didn't just look at transcription factors. We also looked at many, many different types of RNA. So what you've just described as the RNA being made, it's a copy of the DNA that then goes off to make a protein, is very much a sort of traditional view of RNA. Now, in fact, we've long known that there have been RNAs that do other things, sort of structural RNAs, and some regulatory RNAs as microRNAs. We continue to see way more RNA being made in much, much more complicated forms than that tradition, than the early textbook view of this. Now, there's a big debate that is still going on about how much of those complex RNAs are sort of a side product of making some RNAs and how much of those RNAs are doing regulatory functions. We definitely know some of them are doing regulatory functions, but whether that's a small percentage or a large percentage is still not so clear from our data.
So the fact is that in a cell, you see much more single strands of RNA sort of floating about doing various things than you would normally expect.
Yes. I mean, the only caveat about that is I'm not sure that we can be so sure about the doing. So we
see
they're there. They're made. Some cell types make this collection of RNA. Some other cell types do not. For example, when you look at any particular one place, you'll see them come on and off in different cell types. But whether they're there to do something or whether they're there as a side product of something else happening, it's still a very kind of open question. We look at this in slightly more detail than people have previously because we've been able to look genome-wide, and we know that some of those RNAs, these novel RNAs, are under selection in the human population. But unfortunately, the way we go about testing that doesn't give us a percentage. So it could be 5%, it could be 90%.
But is it fair to say that some of those potentially doing RNAs, if that's the technical term,
functional RNAs,
are they coded for within this non-protein coding DNA regions?
So some of them are in what we call intergenic between the genes, but actually quite a few of them are in the middle of the introns, which are traditionally, when you talk about RNA, the gene is made. It's a very long piece of RNA, and then quite substantial parts of it are cut out. And the bits that are cut out are called introns. The traditional view is that those introns then get targeted for being degraded, and the RNA components are recycled. Now, what we've discovered is that quite often there's an important regulatory RNA that comes out of that intron. Now, again, we know enough to know that it definitely happens. What's much harder is to work out the proportion of what we're seeing is doing something or not. And that's going to be a topic of research, I think, for the next 5-10 years for sure.
A lot of this stuff, as you say, as soon as you start to sequence it and understand it, it just produces another set of DNA, RNA, whatever, to actually start to understand. I mean, do you ever, it seems like some Alice in Wonderland sort of situation.
Yeah. So I do appreciate this from the outside that people might say, well, wait a second, didn't we sequence the genome in 2000? Didn't we do this? And that was the starting line. That was the start, not the finish line of this thing. And it's definitely for me a marathon. I remember I was involved in the early analysis of the human genome, and I absolutely remember this feeling that we will be doing this, I think, for this entire century, which is trying to understand how humans work. And like I said, we are one of the most complicated, if not the most complicated machine that we know about is ourselves. And the idea that this was going to be a simple thing to understand is slightly hubris. I find it now difficult. I mean, it's bad enough wrapping your head around C. elegans, which is a small worm with only 600 cells and stuff like that. That's hard enough. A human is just awesome in its complexity. And somehow that complexity is encoded in the genome, which is really remarkable.
Well, I want to go on to the implications for disease and how you might use some of this information in just a bit. But let's just complete the circle a bit more. You talked about the RNAs that are sort of exist in the cell. You talked about the fact that some of them do appear in the non-coding regions of the genome. And there's this idea that there's 6% of the genome, which is traditionally been thought of as junk, non-coding, does have this specific biochemical function. But in the paper, and you said earlier, 80% mm-hmm. has a biochemical function. So 6% you've described, 2%-ish mm-hmm. we know of as genes. What about the rest of the 80? What's that doing?
So the 80%, by the way, is this whenever a gene is switched on, or switched, so genes can be kind of actively switched on. Interestingly enough, genes can also be actively repressed, sort of very deliberately switched off. And basically every place in the genome where we see something biochemical going on, either basically it being on or off, that's the sum of all of that is the 80%. And in many ways that 80% is really saying that indeed nearly every part of the genome is used in some cell type at some point. But it doesn't really have the specificity that I talked about with that 6%, which are these specific switches that somehow is perhaps coding whether it's going on and off at different places. Now, how much, that 6% we might want to double, and there's something of the order between 15 to 20%, 20% estimate is in this specific zone from my perspective. I don't know how much more specificity we will have with all the different bases. And there is a kind of, it's an appropriate question to ask, which is a kind of accountancy of every base and knowing why kind of every base is there. But it is a little bit sort of nerdy and geeky. We don't need to have that level of accountancy. But just to mention that we still know, and ENCODE doesn't change this fundamentally, that quite a bit of the genome comes from these self-copying genome parasites, which we call repeats, dispersed repeats. And they just copy themselves back into just lots and lots of places in the genome. And different species have quite sophisticated ways of trying to keep these parasites under control. And then, interestingly, very occasionally, we actually use the parasites. And there's been some recent evidence. You know, my colleagues, Duncan Odom and Paul Fleechek, have shown that these repeats get used sometimes to deposit new transcription factor binding sites. All of that is to say that there's quite a big chunk of genome which is due to these genome parasites, and that's the explanation for a fair whack of genome.
And these have appeared over evolution from viruses appearing, virus DNA sort of just forcing itself into our genome, but we're still carrying it along.
Yeah, and what's interesting when you look at different species, they very often they're trying to keep all of these things under control, And some genomes do it, some species do it better than others. And so some species have really lost control and the parasites are running amok across the genome. So plant genomes are a bit like that. Whereas other genomes, so fugu, the takifugu, which is this pufferfish, seemingly got totally on top of all of its parasites, cleaned them out, and they don't have any active parasites at the moment. But as you say, another virus could come in and start going, copying itself into the genome. And so this just seems to be something that every genome has to deal with. And there's like I said, quite sophisticated mechanisms that we're starting to understand about how those things are repressed.
Let's talk about the clinical implications. Maybe this is too early, but I want to sort of imagine a future where we're starting to understand more about the regulation factors, transcription factors that are influencing the function of our genes. So in my head, I'm imagining this in this way, that you've got the genes that have particular functions, and sometimes those things can be mutated and you get particular diseases if lots of mutations happen in certain ways. So that could involve one gene, it could involve many, many genes, as we've discovered. Diabetes, there are hundreds of genes involved, and we don't even know if that's the end of the story with mutations. But then also you've got this extra layer, which we're talking about now, which is that you might have a perfectly healthy gene, so to speak, but the transcription factors and the regulation factors around it in the non-coding areas, there's something wrong with those. And they're the ones that may be increasing function or decreasing mm-hmm. function, and you could maybe target those for mm-hmm. Therapies. Tell me if that's right, and how else are we going to start using this information?
So that's absolutely at one level right. The only thing to say is it's not this distinction about those 100 mutations in genes and then regulatory stuff different. In fact, that's what diabetes, when people talk about hundreds of different genes or hundreds of different loci, they include all the regulatory elements. We've always been able to know that those places, these anonymous places in the genome, were involved in risk. We just didn't know what they do. And now they look like they are involved in regulation. And so let me try and sort of give you the practical example of Crohn's disease. I think quite a lot of Crohn's biologists think that there's an environmental trigger for Crohn's, for the onset of Crohn's. Different bacterial infections is a candidate for that trigger. But a lot of this is about how sensitive your immune system is to perhaps a particular bacterial subtype coming in and triggering it. And then if you're tuned to be a bit too sensitive, your immune system's a bit too trigger happy, it goes into this disease-causing autoimmune thing where the immune system turns on yourself. So the shift in risk for Crohn's disease may have nothing to do with the proteins about the immune system, but some to do with that, but some to do with how sensitive that regulation is. And so now it becomes quite easy to work out that maybe there's a place in the middle of nowhere, not close to a protein coding gene, but if you have one variant, you're more sensitive to this bacteria. If you have another variant, you're less sensitive. And so you get Crohn's disease probably because you have the more sensitive type and that particular bacterial infection occurred at a particular time when you were vulnerable. Whereas somebody else who has the low-risk variant, the switch is set to a different sensitivity and they don't get Crohn's from this.
And so in a sense, it seems daunting to be building up such a vast database on every single possible genetic-caused disease. We've been doing that for a long time anyway through various other techniques. Do you think that you said earlier that this is going to be a job for the rest of the century? It seems like we're never going to quite know if we've got to the end of it. Will we ever know?
So I don't think we'll know completely. Remember, again, to stress it, this genome amazingly makes one of us, and it is a bit awesome when you think about it. That said, I think there are some low-hanging fruit between now and, 2100 or whatever it is. So I don't think we have to have kind of a full knowledge for this knowledge to help us impact on how we think about disease and how we think about improving health.
And indeed, health. It already has done. A lot of genetic information has been very useful, despite the fact that it hasn't cured everything.
So. Yeah, and despite the fact that we don't know everything, right? So you don't... You know, having full knowledge doesn't preclude you from using things in different ways. And in many ways, ENCODE is if it's its main impact is both speeding up research, so researchers do not have to do all the experiments that they might think they have to when they're studying something. But I think far more exciting for me is this business of, because it's systematic, we can make an association that somebody would not have necessarily said. They may not have said, oh, let's look at this cell type for this disease. It may not have been on anybody's radar. But in some sense, because we've done both the disease studies and ENCODE genome-wide, we can make that association in the computer statistically.
Now, tell me how you actually started to, how you did your work. So in the case of sequencing a genome, you just get, I assume, a cell from someone, and or a couple of cells or many cells, and you just read off the ACGT sequence. In your case, you can do that, but in a sense, you won't know what the functions are unless you're doing something to them. So to my slightly dumb mind, explain how you did the functionality testing.
So the first thing to say is I'm really a representative of this consortium of scientists. There are 440 scientists on the main across all the different papers being published at the moment.
Which is, let's just say, there's more than 30 different scientific papers being published, and an entire database and an iPad app, I believe.
Yep.
I mean, this is a dense amount of data which anyone can go around and have a look at. So we'll, that's wow, frankly.
So so it is it's a kind of one of these. You know, so I'm one of those 440 scientists, in each case there has been a sort of scientific group, each one of those sometimes being a consortium across multiple labs, looking at a particular functional area. Now, in some sense, you have to go area by area. This is what we do for RNA. This is what we do for histones. This is what we do for transcription factors. This is what we do for methylation. But in fact, there's quite a lot of commonality for this, because in each case, you do some piece of biochemistry to try and capture the molecules that you're interested in. And by making sure that the molecules that you capture are DNA or RNA based, then you can put it onto these new next generation sequences. And those sequences are so cheap that you can really make these experiments scale very, very well. And so although at some level there's a huge variety of biochemical techniques, how you capture RNA is very different from how you capture DNA. And when we capture DNA, we talk about it as chromatin, which is this combination of DNA and protein. So we call it chromatin immunoprecipitation. The next stage, the readout stage, is the same. It's a next-generation sequencer. And then we have different analysis methods. This is a very, very computationally intense project, because each time we generate these data sets, we have four or five steps before you even get to ask sort of sophisticated scientific questions that have to be executed very carefully.
So going back to the sort of the basic lab bit of this, you have many scores of cell types, so liver cells, heart cells, whatever else, in which each of these cells, only a certain proportion of the genome is actually were doing something. And so you can then, from that, looking at the RNAs produced in each cell, looking at all the histones and all those sorts of things produced in each cell, work out which bits of the genome are functioning, which bits have been silenced, and all of that. And that, is that how you start to build up the catalog?
That's exactly right. So we studied 167 different cell types. Now, some of them were what we might call laboratory workhorses. This is what molecular biologists have been using for a long time in the lab. And those very often are cancer cell lines. But about half of them were direct cell types from the body, as direct as we can get. We still need to have something like 5 million cells for every experiment.
So what kinds of cells are they? Just give us a list.
Yes. So some of the cancer cell lines are things like HeLa and HepG2. So HeLa is the classic laboratory cell line. HepG2 is a liver cancer that many people have studied in the lab. But then some of the normal, much more normal cell lines were direct liver extracts, endothelial cells from umbilical cords, so from the umbilical cord veins, endothelial cells, and stem cells. These are cells which cells, which we derive from embryos and can be differentiated in the lab. So you can keep them in this sort of embryonic state, but you can also let them differentiate into neurons, to little organoids and funky stuff. So that's the kind of collection of different cell types that we looked at. So in addition, we looked at around just over 100 different types of experiments. So there's different ways of looking at each of those cell types. Now, most of those different types of experiments were different ways, different transcription factors. So to look at a transcription factor, we take an antibody. Now, an antibody is a protein that you make that can bind to another protein specifically. There are about 2,000 different types of transcription factors, and we looked at 116 different transcription factors in ENCODE. So we have all of these different experiments and all these different cell types. Now, there was no way we could look at that product, at all experiments by all cell types. So there were 6 cell lines in which we did the majority of the experiments, and then there are 20 types of experiment that we did across the majority of the cell lines. So very deliberately, we explored these two axes independently, and that was a good piece of experimental design. Previously, we had not done that, and that was a big regret of mine, so that we could do integration in particular on these 6 cell types. 3 of those 6 were classic cancer cell types. 3 of them were more normal cell types.
Okay, so in a sense now, you've done the, again, just to go back to your original figures, this explains about 6% of the non-coding. You reckon there's another 6 to 12%?
Six to 12%, yeah. Depending on...
Is that the next step of ENCODE?
That is indeed the next step of ENCODE. I actually will not have the same role as I did this time around. So there are a bunch of my colleagues and other new people who will join the ENCODE consortium, no doubt, who have the fun about building it out to all 2,000 factors and probably about 2,000 different
cell
types.
How long will that take?
The funding is for 5 years, so they will definitely do something at the end of in 5 years. I think it's ambitious, but doable.
In terms of size, it's much, much bigger than the original Human Genome Project collaboration. I mean, that took a long time because the sequencing technology was much older. And I mean, it has to be said that one of the reasons you can do this now is the sequencing technology is much cheaper, much faster, more accurate, even in just 10 years. So you can actually get to this sort of level of detail. So between now and 5 years' time, you imagine that the technology will get even better and even cheaper.
So that's what we think. There's quite a lot of biochemistry as well to do, and people haven't necessarily had the same technological advantages in the biochemistry as we've had in sequencing. So there are some very hard parts of this problem as well. Another hard issue to work out is really accessing all the different cell types in the human body. So if you think about it, ideally one would like to be able to access any cell type in any developmental stage. Now that's a very hard ask for humans, much easier ask for mice. And so thankfully we will be doing both mice and humans in parallel in the next phase of the project.
Now, can I ask a few more general questions about sort of where then genetics research like yours is going? You're building these enormous catalogs, and then people are going to go and search through them, find meaning, annotate them, and continuously for a long time to come. Every year, newspapers are full of stories about personal genomics. Yeah. This idea that you can get your genome sequenced; it's dead cheap. Give it to your doctor and they will store it, and they'll be able to provide you with genome specific drugs in 10 years. They'll provide you with ideas of what kinds of mental degradation might happen to you. Who knows? Of course, the problem with all this is that it's very hard to tell you specifically what's going to happen to you, even if you know the genetic information. If we have to start storing this other stuff as well about people, you know, all these transcription factors and all this, it increases the amount of information. Do you think it actually increases... I mean, if someone wants to get their genome sequenced, that's great. But does it increase the amount of knowledge we have about that person's future?
So I think we are still feeling our way forwards here. But I'm someone who I'm very positive about the direction. So I think we already are at the stage where we use genetics and genomics in these very specific cases, and some point in the next 5 or 10 years it will become more obvious that we should just have it as a routine part of healthcare. But it's not going to change healthcare in a very deep way. I think of it a bit like x-rays. So x-rays, imagine the world. There was a world before x-rays. You didn't know what was going on inside of people's bodies. And when x-rays were invented, in fact, there's an incredibly interesting history of medicine about the discovery of x-rays and how they've been exploited. So suddenly people could see inside of people's bodies. It really changed some aspects of medicine, but not all aspects of medicine. And critically, it's not sort of completely definitive. Sometimes it's really useful. Do you have a broken bone or not? Answer, yes, no. Yeah. But other times it's really just helping the doctor work out precisely what is wrong or how to go the next step. I think the genome will be used in a very similar manner to x-rays in the future. I wouldn't surprise me if there won't be a kind of medical specialty about genomic medicine or whatever we end up calling, just as there is about radiology. So doctors whose job it is to stay on the cutting edge of genomic research in the context of practicing healthcare. And I'm working with a number of doctors who I think the same way, and that's really exciting. Now, doing medicine, genomic medicine, it's going to be a long task because we have to study enough of it in the right circumstances to really affect medicine. And there's lots of bets being placed effectively by different researchers about what's going to be the most effective route. Will it be about rare genetic diseases, which we might be able to find across the entire population? I quite like that approach and as one thing. But maybe it's far more about cancer genomics. A lot of people think that cancer is going to be our very first early win because cancer seems to be a very genomic disease, and you can tailor drugs not necessarily to you, but really to your cancer that you get and say, this is the right set of drugs for that cancer. But maybe just as important is infectious biology. So the fact that we'll be able to find out what's infecting you when you get a hospital-acquired infection. But before you even do that, I think we will be sequencing the floors of hospitals regularly and understanding what is the bacteria, like an immune system for every hospital, to know what are the potential outbreaks that could be happening in that area. And so before it even happens, we can monitor it. Now, there's probably five or six other things that I don't know about that are perfectly feasible ways of using genomics and genomics technologies in healthcare. And at a first approximation, we should be exploring all of them. And then one can get into a bit of a bun fight about which ones deserve more money than others. And that's a bun fight for scientists and clinicians to have between us.
So, I mean, this idea of junk DNA, which we started with, we can categorically say that junk DNA probably doesn't exist. So where does it leave that idea that there's large tracts of genome that don't do anything?
I mean, I just think that's it's quite a pervasive metaphor. Junk DNA and the idea that there's the important stuff and lots of stuff that's not sort of being used. I just don't think it's a very useful way of thinking about the genome. I just want to expunge it from textbooks. I just think it's not helpful. That's not to say that all of the genome is definitely doing something useful. Like I said, there are these genomic parasites, these repeats that copy themselves. Clearly not all of them are useful because we've turned them over in our history. But I want to reset the kind of null hypothesis towards most of the genome or good whack of genome is doing something.
Can I ask you, just as a sort of addendum to everything, I think we've got all the stuff from the paper, but how does your work and the stuff you're finding out about the RNAs and the microRNAs and so on, how's that helping to understand this other related idea of epigenetics, this idea of environmental factors affecting the way genes express themselves?
So in effect, ENCODE is an epigenetic project. What we are studying, many of the assays and experiments we do are straight up epigenetics, and certainly all this regulation is combined with is epigenetics. Epigenetics is a slightly complicated word because it's come to mean two things scientifically. So one thing its original definition was transgenerational inheritance that's not DNA based. its other definition has come to mean cell type state. So why does a liver cell know it's a liver cell and not a hair cell? So it's this second use of the word epigenetics that ENCODE is part of, and that is, or that second business, the somatic state business, is still is where most of the interest is coming from, and is where this environment aspect is coming from. So the idea is that the environment affects us, and some very often that environment, we have some memory of that environment in our bodies. So something has to, there has to be some molecular memory of some previous environmental exposures. And epigenetics is a great candidate for that molecular memory.
The idea being that something in the environment, chemical or whatever else, is affecting which genes express themselves to what extent in different parts of the body.
Yes. So not only that something in the environment is changing the expression. I mean, we always knew that. You have an infection of a virus. Indeed, our body reacts. It does things. You have a particular chemical. It does that. What's more interesting is that you, a particular chemical, and somehow you still know about having had that chemical a year later. And something in our system knows about this, all the things. So the flip side of genetics, which doesn't get talked about enough, when we study all the differences due to genetics, we automatically discover all the differences also that were not due to genetics. And this thing we often call the environment, but in many ways it's a whole host of different things, including what we would call free will, our decisions about doing stuff. Just as we get better and better at understanding genetics, in many ways we'll get better and better at characterizing what's left on the other side.
There must be some physical manifestation of this memory, and in neuroscience now, the idea of memory is that you have networks of neurons that fire in a certain sequence, and that is what a memory is. It's that sort of, and the more you think about something, the more strengthened it gets. I don't want to make crude analogies because I know they just don't work. But in your genome, in your non-coding bits, where could that memory lie?
Well, so the really exciting thing, and this is why people have found it fascinating, is that a lot of the epigenetic mechanisms that have been discovered are about chemical modifications of DNA or of histones, which are the proteins which DNA winds around. So DNA is not naked in the cell. It's wound around these proteins called histones. And these chemical modifications are very long-lived, and there's quite a lot of machinery that makes sure, for example, that the modification goes into daughter cells. So once you've set up a particular modification, even if the cell divides, very often that modification will be faithfully replicated along with the DNA. So this is why epigenetic mechanisms are a very good candidate for molecular memory, and are very, very interesting. And really worth, so ENCODE being an epigenetic kind of study, it's just part of us understanding how our genome works and how it interacts with the environment. Somehow, whether you got infected by virus A or virus B is sort of memorized somewhere in the system.
And the work you're doing at ENCODE would capture that, some of that information.
Yes, I mean, it's part of this very, very broad area of trying to understand this business. I would hate to, you know, we're definitely not the only scientific group looking at it. There are many, many, many other groups and some big projects that are also out to look at this. So it's quite an exciting area of research, and it's kind of fun to be part of.
Can I just ask you a final question about when you started doing research into genetics, when you were doing your PhD, can I guess in the early 90s, late 80s, something like that?
So I did my PhD, in the late 90s.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Did you even begin to expect that this would go on this long?
So again, I was very lucky because during my PhD was the genome, and I got involved in genomic analysis very, very early on. So I've had a lot of fun doing this. I have always, considered myself lucky to do this research, but also known that it's going to take at least the length of my career and many, much, much longer to understand this. And I think the perspective to think about this is it is hard to understand C. elegans. C. elegans is this tiny roundworm. It has a defined set of cells. It only has 140 neurons. You would imagine that if, you know, if we should have mastery of an organism that kind of wriggles, here is an organism that we should have mastery. And we are miles away from having mastery of that organism, really understanding how it works. And so when you see that and you put that into humans into that context with so much more cells, cell types, and then this amazing organ, the brain, which I don't even want to think about understanding, it's very, very daunting. But you've got to just keep at the problem. You've got to keep working at it. I do remember, 2003, 2004, just not having any understanding of how the genome worked in any deep way beyond the fact that it encoded proteins. Now I feel like I have a better list of places I should look at. It is a much, much bigger list than I was expecting. It is much more complicated than I could even dream about back then, but it is perhaps the truth.
Your project at the EBI near Cambridge is one of these massive international projects, as you said, to catalogue all of this stuff, and it'll continue for another 5 years at least. Just for the purposes of people who don't know about the size of these sorts of things and the number of international collaborations that go on, can you just highlight for me in the constellation of big genomics projects, mm-hmm. what are the other big ones trying to understand the genome from slightly different ways that you know kind of all combine and will produce stuff that isn't necessarily being repeated but is shedding light onto different parts of the genome, different understandings, different connections between them?
Yeah.
What's the laundry list?
So the genome sequence itself that was done in 2003 still continues because there were some very, very hard bits of the genome that we sort of officially said too hard to do in 2003. And we have to have, this is some dedicated people getting out there and finishing, continuing to push that. Then there are basically two very big themes that come off of this. So one of them is this variation between people. We had what was called the HapMap project, and then the follow-on from that is the 1,000 Genomes project, where people have looked at about 1,000, it's slightly more actually, people around the world, and just said, this is how we are different genetically. And then part of that same stream now is a whole host of consortia around diseases. So they're focused usually on one disease, and now they're trying to understand that disease. And very often genetics gives them a big crowbar into the disease. It doesn't tell you everything. In many ways, it leaves you somewhat more confused than it did previously, but it's a really wonderful route into a particular disease. And so that list goes on for a very long time. There's probably 5,000 different consortia out there across different diseases. Then on the flip side is this ability or us wanting to understand how the genome works in more detail. And ENCODE is part of that project or that theme. And the other big project to talk about in this context is called the Epigenome, and there's the Human Epigenome Consortium. And really, these projects are pretty much very similarly aligned about trying to understand the cell state decisions, what makes a liver cell, and what makes a kidney cell a kidney cell.
So how do you go from the sequence as an inert bit of chemical to all the functions of the body?
Well, yes, and all the functions of the body, let's stay away from all the functions of the body and just go to all the cell types in the body. That's hard enough at this stage. That project, and so these projects will still have a trajectory that task needs to be done, but it's going to be quite exciting, I think, when that's we've done all 2,000 transcription factors, whereas ENCODE, this first phase of ENCODE, has only looked at 116, which is still a large number, but not 2,000. Then I would imagine, or I think that will continue to have some other reference human projects. Now, whether you call these genomics or phenomics or something else, I don't care. I think we need to have more reference human normals. So how the reference human anatomy in really fine detail, reference human physiology in really high detail, metabolomics, how different organs are built and everything else. And I think I can see a future where there is a group of people saying, right, I really, truly want to come up with a good, proper working model of the liver. And probably you could, the liver may not be, I'm not sure it's the best thing, but at least there's not many different cell types in the liver, so you can have a stab at that scenario. Another aspect to talk about here is heart muscle. For example, there's quite a good physiological heart muscle model, and connecting that model up with a three-dimensional model of the organ and also a model of the molecular biology and biochemistry that's happening inside of those heart cells would be really great. So I think we've got that. That maybe that's two decades away of producing this kind of these kind of models. But I think it's conceptually feasible and quite exciting to think about. That's enough for me, certainly. And that's complicated enough for anyone. You don't really need to dream up anything more difficult to get your teeth into.
Gosh, I thought that theoretical physics and the Large Hadron Collider stuff was complicated. But any budding scientist out there, this is definitely the field to go into. There's jobs aplenty.
So absolutely.
Good jobs.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing to say is this is very, very computational. And so half of the scientists in ENCODE, roughly speaking, were computational people, statisticians. And we have a headache in biology because we have a real need for quantitative biologists, quantitative people with strong quantitative skills. So if you're a physicist listening to this and you're a bit bored of high energy physics and you're saying to yourself, ooh, I want a proper challenge, then we've got a great success stories of physicists who've come in. It usually takes about between 3 to 5 years to properly kind of convert, but we really need them, and we need mathematicians and statisticians. One of the really nice things in this project is we worked with a very high-end statistical group in Berkeley, UC Berkeley, and so I'm very positive about this area of science.
A huge thanks to Dr. Ewan Burney there. And to read Alok Jha's feature on the state of genomic research, just head over to guardian.co.uk/science.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.